Hello, it's Monday, January the 25th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Daily Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, would you wear a wristband which would tell your employers whether you're happy or unhappy? In football, Chelsea manager Frank Lampard, one of Chelsea's greatest heroes, has been sacked by a Roman Abramovich. Summer holidays, they're under threat. They're not going to happen if you want to go abroad, because if you do go abroad, you're going to have to check into a hotel when you get back. Nicola Sturgeon, the SNP leader, has warned she's going to hold another referendum on Scottish independence, even though it won't be legally binding. But first, already, £250,000 has poured into the Daily Mail's Mailforce campaign, Get a Kid a Computer. We'd like your support. One in three families don't have enough computers for their children to do homeschooling in lockdown. That's according to a poll in the Mail today. It ties in with the Mail's campaign to get laptops to lockdown pupils. So far, the Mail has already raised £250,000, and that's just in the first weekend. Big names like Bill Gates and the children's author David Walliams, actor too, of course, are supporting it. We're also getting checks for a fiver from pensioners who are worried their grandchildren don't have a proper computer at home. In today's Mail, our columnist Sarah Vine has written an impassioned piece on why the campaign is so important, and she joins me now. Sarah, we've made the point very clearly in this campaign to get more laptops and computers to kids being taught at home. This is no criticism of the government. They've ordered 1.3 million laptops, 850,000 have arrived. This is just us piling in to help.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a continuation of all the brilliant work that we did with Mailforce on PPE. And I think it's just a way that one can be, you know, the Mail has shown that it can be very constructive in very difficult times. And as you say, it's not really a sort of, it's not meant to be a criticism. It's just, you know, these are very extraordinary times. I mean, I've written a lot about why I think schools should be reopened and why they should be classified as essential services and why I think teachers should be vaccinated, because the statistics about what lockdown is doing to children, I mean, some children, particularly in the Northeast, are estimated to be 22 months behind on their learning.
Terrible.
I mean, that is.
How do they ever get that back?
Exactly. I mean, and of course, with all these things, it's always the kids who have the least advantages in life that suffer the most, and they are the ones who will end up, you know, they will end up going off the rails and being in the prison system. So it's not just a question of, you know, oh, you know, we all want, you know, mummies looking after their kids. It's a wider societal thing as well. We have to protect, you know, this generation. And I think that until they can get the schools open again, and I think they should absolutely have that top of their priority list. And as I said, I think we should vaccinate teachers as a priority. I think this is the next best thing. And, you know, I've got, both my children are at school in London, and they both have friends who have sort of slightly fallen off the grid because they just don't have the hardware.
That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, can you imagine how your children would be coping if they didn't have the computers or iPads at home?
Well, my children are very lucky because I give them all my old laptops. So they've both got hand-me-down laptops, which, you know, still sort of are a bit creaky, but they still work fine because obviously I'm a writer, so I go through them quite a pace. But you know, I've got my daughter's got a friend who's trying to do her stuff on a phone, and that's kind of impossible, really. And then my son has got friends who are very, very bright, who ought to do really, really well, but who have just sort of disengaged completely because they find the whole process just too difficult. And I think that's the key thing. So we do have to try and make the sort of hardware work. Of course, the other thing is the broadband. Because, you know, it's no good having a computer if you can't log onto the internet and access lessons. And that is something that the government, I think, possibly also needs to have a think about, because I'm not sure that the coverage is as good as it could be. But I suppose that will come.
And part of the campaign, what we're encouraging, as you know, Sarah, many companies upgrade their laptops, they upgrade their computers.
Yeah.
The old ones just sit in cupboards, or worse, go on a rubbish tip. What we're saying is hand them over, because we can use the money being raised through Mail readers to upgrade them. It only costs £15 per laptop to make them school friendly.
And I think we're doing it through Computer Centre, aren't we? And I have bought refurbished computers off them myself, actually, for my own use. And And they're really good at what they do. They take some old hardware and they update it. And I think it's a great idea. And there are lots of companies that have stuff knocking around that they're not using. But, you know, the point is, I think it's all about trying to be as constructive as possible. And I know it's all very nightmarish and difficult and everything. But, you know, as a mother of two children, I know that trying to get them to share a computer to do online lessons would be almost
a nightmare, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Complete nightmare. Yeah.
Just finally, Sarah, we're calling it Computers for Kids. It's really caught on very quickly, much like the PPE campaign. Do you detect in government a great warmth from them that we're doing this, or are they worried that people will think?
I think they're quite happy with it. Yes, I think they are. I mean, as you know, my husband is ex-education secretary, so he's.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember him bringing in that rule that said that you know, that fining parents for not sending their children to school, you know, years and years ago. When he was education secretary. And the reason he did that was because all of the studies, all of the statistics, all of the information, all of the teachers, every single piece of data said that the most important thing for children is to get them into school. That is vital for their well-being. And that's why they brought in this sort of fine for parents who take their kids out of school to go on, you know, holidays or whatever. That has not changed. You know, that is still the case. And, you know, that's how important it is to get kids in school, you know, that you would fine their parents for not making them go. And that none of that has changed. And I think the government know that. They're just, you know, they're just in the most impossible position, because whenever they try to do anything, you know, up goes the cry of, oh, well, you don't care about the people dying. And that's not true. They do care deeply about the people dying. They'd like it to stop. But they also have to balance that with, you know, the prospect of a child losing 22 months of education and just never being able to recoup that, and the repercussions that will have for that person throughout their life, the fact that they won't be able to probably go on to further education, they won't be able to enter the workforce in any sort of meaningful or constructive way, they may then become, you know, have problems with drugs or crime or alcohol, and then they will, you know, and it will be a spiral. These are not immediate deaths. These are not people who are sitting in hospital with masks on their faces, but they are on the horizon, and that, you know, they're very important. They're just as important as anybody else. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's Sarah Vine. She's written a very powerful piece about the campaign. It's called Computers for Kids. It's running in the mail all week, and if you can spare some cash, we'd love to have it. And if you've got some old laptops, we can take them off your hands too. Now, remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News, and you'll get the latest from Mail Plus. And at 5, of course, you get to hear the latest Daily Show. So the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has announced she's going to hold another independence referendum if, as widely expected, the SNP cruise to victory in the Scottish elections in May. The First Minister has accused Boris Johnson of being frightened of democracy and said she'd go ahead regardless of whether Westminster consents or not. Here to explain what all this means is Angus McNeill, who is an SNP MP who's forgiven me because I'm not going to attempt to pronounce his very Scottish-sounding constituency. Mr McNeill, even if she were to hold a referendum later this year or even next year, the result isn't binding. It's just playing politics, isn't it?
Well, results are never binding in referendums. However, when the people speak, legally that is, when the people speak, they are listened to. And we know that the people want to speak in Scotland, and 20 opinion polls on the trot show which direction they're going to speak in as well. So we're as well to get an answer for them sooner rather than later. And it's a welcome departure that the Scottish government have realised and have accepted finally that Boris Johnson isn't going to play ball. He doesn't want the Scottish people to speak, and they're ready to go ahead without his agreement. This makes the Scottish people more important in this process than Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, and that's the way it should be.
But of course, legally and constitutionally, the referendum will have no legal basis because it has to be authorised by the government in Westminster. That's correct, isn't it?
Well, not really, because states are seceding don't particularly usually have the agreement of the state they're leaving from. They'll have the agreement of everybody else. But, you know, I think better of Westminster anyway than that. I mean, I think when we put the votes in the ballot box. And, you know, I would prefer to make this at the election in May rather than the referendum. But I'm glad that the Scottish Government are moving, because you've got to remember, a referendum is not guaranteed that the powers of the Scottish Parliament are there to hold it. And that is accepted in Nicola Sturgeon and Michael Russell's plan, that the 11-point plan at point 10. So it's not certain that they can get that through. But if they do, the Scottish people will be listened to. But, you know, why don't we just do it in May at the election and make your mandate for independence directly, and on we go. It's going to happen anyway, Andrew. I think everybody knows it is.
I think so,
we're better moving on sooner rather than later.
Now, if the latest poll suggested the margin of victory for your side would be 52-48, now, I instantly thought about that. You know where I'm going with this conversation, the referendum on the European Union. Many people said, 4 points, you know, margin of error, it was not a decisive enough margin. Do you really think a 52-48 is enough to say to the United Kingdom, we're off?
Well, I think 52-48 turned out to be decisive enough. Just look at the United Kingdom. It's outside the single market and the customs union alongside Russia and Belarus, as the only major European states that are. It seems to be able to decide things. But, you know, that was a low poll for Scottish independence, the 52-48. Some of the better ones are up at 58%. So we'll take our chances on the day when the ballot box speaks, whether it's at a referendum or at an election. You know, and, you know, I think the crucial thing that's probably missed by a number of people is the movement of the Scottish government away from Westminster must give permission, Westminster must agree, to now moving on and the feeling and the realisation that Westminster is not the most important in this at all, despite their courtesies towards Westminster. The most important are the Scottish people, and that is a movement that we may yet see. This decided the election in May. There's a case going through the Court of Session in Scotland at the moment that may well say in the next week or two that the Scottish Parliament doesn't have these powers. And knowing that the Section 30 referendum with Boris's agreement is blocked, and if this Parliament doesn't have the powers, we'll be left with May the 6th. So, you know, it's a developing and happening situation in Scotland.
But this is an emotional and political thing, isn't it, Mr. McNeill? It's not based on sound economics, because, you know, I'm just looking at the most recent figures. In 2019-2020, public spending per head in Scotland was 12.4% above the UK average. So that's we taxpayers down in England insulating taxpayers in Scotland through our taxes.
Well, unfortunately, the UK taxpayer has not paid his own way or paid for the UK since about 2003, and that itself was a blip. So the UK is printing money and borrowing money left, right and centre. But I would point you to something more substantial than that. I'd point you to the UN Human Development Index this year, and in particular to the country at number 2 spot, and that country was Ireland. And you will remember, of course, that up to 100 years ago, before the UK of Great Britain and Northern Ireland was formed, that Ireland was part of the United Kingdom, and it was the worst and the poorest part. It was worse than Wales. And Ireland then became independent, losing the 6 counties that had most of the industry. And you'd have thought that was a basket case that was going nowhere. It didn't have oil or volumes of whiskey like Scotland. And you come back 100 years later and you find out that Ireland is wealthier per capita than all the United Kingdom, leapfrogged all the 4 countries of the United Kingdom, or the 3 countries and a bit of the United Kingdom, and is now number 2 in the World UN Human Development Index, just behind Norway, Scotland's neighbour to the east that has the oil. So, you know, I think we're prepared to take our chances in Scotland. You know, we're in good company to the east and the west of us. I don't think things will be too bad.
Okay, I've asked you just finally, Nicola Sturgeon was asked about this by Andrew Marr, about the growing tension between her and your previous leader, Alex Salmond. He was cleared of all those sex harassment cases in court. How toxic is this an issue for the SNP? And isn't the talk about a referendum a convenient distraction?
I would say it's not helpful talk at all, and you know, everything will come out in the wash. It's far too far above my pay grade, and they're just speculating what's going to happen. But, you know, I hope the facts come out and everybody sees what really happened.
But, I mean, he's still a very popular man, isn't he, Mr. McNeill?
Well, they both are very popular, which is a good thing for the independence movement. But independence is bigger than any individual, and that's something that we all know in Scotland. I don't think individuals affect the polls too much. People realise we can do things better in Scotland, regardless who the leader is. And is independence a distraction from that, or that a distraction from independence? things happen in life, and a week's a long time in politics. We've just got to get on with the main goal and making Scotland maybe leapfrog Ireland and Norway to be number one in the UN Human Development Index that I mentioned earlier. But that certainly isn't going to happen for as long as we're in the UK, stuck as it is in the late teens in the UN Human Development Index, with, as we know, Food Bank Britain is not the place for Scotland to be.
That's Angus McNeill, the SNP MP for a Highland constituency with a very complicated name. Now they can see why I didn't attempt to do it, Alex.
The Isles of the West or the Outer Hebrides. And when COVID's over, we hope some of your listeners come to visit. They'll be very welcome.
So, a new threat to summer holidays, because Britons returning from abroad may be forced to quarantine in hotels for 10 days. That's right. So, if you go abroad on holiday, normally you're going to stay in a villa or a tent or a hotel. But on your return, you have to stay in another hotel for 10 days and you will pick up the bill. It's all to do with border control and COVID. Joining me to discuss this is Paul Charles, who's chief executive at the PC agency, which is advising airlines on managing the crises. And he's also, of course, a former communications director at Virgin Atlantic. Paul Charles, every time we speak, it seems to have got a little bit worse for your industry. Now, the big meeting of the COVID committee is tomorrow, Tuesday, some point in the day. We know that people coming in from certain hotspot countries, such as Brazil or South Africa, where there's the new variant of COVID, will have to check into hotels for 10 days. But now we're being told everybody who goes abroad will have to check in for 10 days. So you can't get off the plane and go home. You check into a hotel and pick up the bill.
Yes, there are, Andrew, sometimes good stories in the travel industry, so it's not all doom and gloom. But this is certainly a retrograde step if it's introduced by the government. And it's understandable, of course, from a health point of view, that we need to keep variants out, new variants out. And so it's important to identify those high-risk countries. But the danger of bringing in a blanket new measure for everybody, where everybody coming into the UK has to quarantine for 10 days in a hotel, is going to destroy the aviation and travel sector in the UK. Because the chances are, once it's in place, this government will take a long time to remove those measures. Now, if the government sets out very clearly a roadmap for an exit, for how it gets out of it by, say, April, then that would be more acceptable. But my fear, and the fear of the whole sector, is that these measures would be in place for some time, as they have been in Australia.
I was going to say the role model is Australia, but that's a much smaller country, and I don't think it has such a reliance. I don't think the travel and tourism industry is anything like as important in Australia as it is in the United Kingdom.
Well, it's not a good role model from the point of view that Britain is more interconnected. Britain is an interconnected global trading hub. This isn't just about holidays. It's about people seeing loved ones that they haven't seen for a long time. It's about cargo. It's about businesses connecting with each other in Europe. And post-Brexit, that's even more important than ever. So the danger is that you adopt a model similar to Australia, you cut off Britain from the rest of the world, and Britain economically and mentally, actually, for all of us in lockdown, is not in a good position to be able to do that.
And the difference, again, as you say, about the interconnectivity, people go to Australia, they tend to go for 2 or 3 weeks because it's such a long way from anywhere. People come to Britain for an afternoon. They come for a business meeting, and they don't necessarily want to do it on Zoom because we're all fed up to the back teeth of Zoom.
Well, that's right. And while Zoom may be important for some meetings, clearly there are contracts to be signed and deals to be done from a business point of view, which do involve people seeing each other eye to eye and face to face. If you're a car manufacturer, you're not going to do the deal over Zoom to invest hundreds of millions of pounds in part of the northeast of England. So it's really important that Britain retains this connectivity. I obviously fully understand the medical need for us to keep new variants out, but the government has to publish an economic impact assessment of the damage these measures would do. There's no doubt they would do damage. So let's see what the government is quantifying that damage as, and then let's have the decision for them to introduce hotel quarantine once we all understand and it's transparent the amount of damage, job losses, business casualties that could occur.
It would also be, I'm just thinking, not just the business trip, it's the death of the weekend break. People who come to London, for instance, or to Edinburgh, and they want to do theatres and restaurants and shopping, all going to stop if they've got to spend 10 days in a hotel first.
Yes, and understandably now maybe isn't the time for that. It's important to pause maybe some things like that. But if you put these measures in place, the chances are the government will not rush to take them away. And when there's no visibility, when consumers aren't clear when the measures are going to be taken away, then they won't book. And when they don't book, that's when you see the collapse of jobs, you see businesses going under because there's no cash flow or revenues coming in. And that's when you destroy an aviation and travel sector that has helped to build Britain over the last decades. So it would be a retrograde step. Variants may never stop. As with other viruses, variants keep appearing. So there needs to be another way. And the other way is testing, testing and more testing on a daily basis.
Just finally, I talked to on this podcast last week, the owner of a chain of pubs, who said if it's true that the hospitality industry is going to be shut down till May, as opposed to the middle of March, that's it, he's closing up shop. How much longer can some of our airlines, even flagship companies like Virgin Atlantic, who used to work for, how much longer can they continue to sustain the losses that they're running at the moment before people like Richard Branson just think to hell with it and walk away?
It's a very good question. Having worked for Richard Branson, he doesn't throw in the towel very often, so I suspect he'll want to carry on. But when Virgin Atlantic itself raised new funds and got more money in from private equity and other sources in, I think it was September, October last year, the feeling in the sector was that money would last for about 6 months and tie Virgin over, if you like, to a time when people would be travelling again. Well, that 6 months effectively is up in April, May time. And there is a deep fear that some airlines will go under. Virgin, I think, is underlying very, very strong as an airline, actually. They could go down to one plane and I think the brand would survive. But there are other airlines that have much smaller pockets, that have smaller fleets, all around Europe especially, that won't survive this because there's no revenue coming in. That's why the government needs to signal, what's the exit route? What's the game plan here? And how does the end game look? And I think they could put these measures in place, say, to the end of March, and then the Prime Minister would say, we're certain we're going to reduce these measures at the end of March. We just need to keep variants out now. But the fear is, if you're not vaccinating 80% of the population before September this year, then these measures may well be in place until that point. And that would mean the death of the sector.
All right, that's Paul Charles, Chief Executive at the PC Agency. And of course, we will bring you the latest on what the government decides to do about hotels as soon as we know. So it's a pretty seismic day in football, even by the standards of Chelsea, who seem to like getting rid of their managers. Frank Lampard, one of Chelsea's all-time heroes, has been sacked as manager. Tim Nicholls, of course, is the Daily Mail's deputy sports editor, who can tell us why. I presume, Tim, the results simply weren't good enough for that man, Abramovich.
I'm afraid you're right. He's a ruthless owner of a Premier League football club. We've seen him lose patience very quickly with some of the biggest names in football management over the years. You know, he's been there now 17, 18 years, Abramovich. He is, you know, the club has enjoyed huge success in every competition in that time, the likes of which the club have sort of very rarely seen before. And so, you know, you could argue it works, but you know, the fact is, unlike previous managers that Abramovich has sacked, Lampard has got, he's one of the most popular Chelsea players of all time. He signed for the club before the Abramovich era. It was big money at the time, but it was before the Abramovich era. And his game really kicked on under Jose Mourinho during his first spell at Chelsea. He won everything there was to win in the game, Lampard, and became one of the most admired players in the world, a terrific player for both Chelsea and England. So the sort of feeling was he might get a bit more time, might be afforded a bit more time and patience than his predecessors, but that wasn't the case. I mean, in his first season, which was obviously last season, disrupted obviously by the pandemic, he did well. You know, the club weren't allowed to sign any players. They'd been banned from making transfers for a season. He led them to fourth, got to the cup final, got to the last 16 in the Champions League, did okay, and you know, blooded a lot of the club's very, very talented youngsters, which is what football fans love to see when they see players come through from the academy and flourish. But of course, this season was always going to be different. Abramovich sanctioned near enough £250 million worth of new players, new signings, which is a, you know, which is a huge, the biggest outlay that any club has ever made in one summer. And obviously that kind of expenditure brings its own pressures, plus the fact that, you know, Chelsea are expected to challenge and compete for every single competition that they enter. And the fact is, unfortunately for Lampard, you know, their recent form has been very poor. They've lost five of their last eight league games. They're ninth in the league. They're 11 points off the top of the table, where Man United are sitting pretty at the moment. And I'm afraid a club like Chelsea, that's just not good enough. That's unacceptable. And, you know, Abramovich took a decision which, you know, he himself admitted was very difficult. Unlike sacking previous managers, this is a Chelsea legend. Frank Lampard has scored more goals for that club than any other player in history. He is a hero to the fans, adored by the fans. So it's obviously a very difficult decision for Roman Abramovich, but one he felt he had to make. There's still half a season to go. They still can get into the top four. And they're still in two competitions. They're still in the FA Cup after winning against Luton yesterday, and they are still in the Champions League, which resumes next month. So from Abramovich's point of view, the time was now. It had to be done, and it might seem brutal, but that's just the way Abramovich has operated, with great success for a great many years now.
And Tim, you mentioned the fans, how popular he is with the fans. There will be a backlash inevitably, but how will that translate itself? Because nobody's going to a football matches anyway, give or take a couple of thousand. So even if they wanted to stay away to show their disdain, they can't, can they?
Well, they can't. And obviously there's no fans in any ground at the moment. But regardless, even if there were, just as you say, a handful, it'd be very difficult for them to voice their displeasure. And I think, you know, while there will be frustrations, they understand that this is what they've come to expect. You know, it given Chelsea's form and position in the league table, it can't really come as a huge surprise to anyone. But in terms of how the fans convey their frustration, well, like, as you say, they can't, which makes, you know, the appointment of the next manager interesting, because they can sort of appoint anyone they want, really. That it won't matter whether they're popular with the fans or not. The fact is, it looks very likely that it's going to be Thomas Tuchel, who was the Paris Saint-Germain manager. He led them to the Champions League final last year, where they lost against Bayern Munich. Very highly rated young manager, was at Dortmund before PSG. He's expected to take over within the next 24 hours. And it'll be fascinating to see how he gets on, because he's got no experience of English football, but he's a highly rated manager. Abramovich clearly feels that he is the man that can get them into the top four and into the Champions League for next season, which is the very least he would have expected for his huge outlay on transfers in the summer. But, you know, it's unproven in England, and it's he certainly isn't going to have the popularity that Lampard enjoyed. But as the point you made, it's very difficult for fans to get behind people, express their displeasure at the moment, because no one's in the grounds, Andrew. Football is a very different experience from what it usually is. We're coming up to a year now without fans in the ground, and it is a different thing entirely, I'm afraid. You know, we miss them. We miss the fans. They are the lifeblood of the game, and it's a huge shame they're not there. And, you know, for Chelsea fans, they would have been very supportive, I would have thought, in recent weeks about Lampard. You know, everybody knew he was under pressure. The results weren't going for them, but I'm sure that the Stamford Bridge fans would have been right behind him, right until the end. Yesterday they beat Luton in the Cup. They would have been singing his name from the rafters. But that might have swayed Abramovich's thinking. But without any fans, Abramovich could make the cool, calculated decision, and he's done it. And you know, it'll be interesting to see where Chelsea go from here now.
Indeed, but a good piece of news as well, Tim. Before you go, we won the second test match against Sri Lanka.
We have. It didn't look likely, but a fantastic bowling display today. And then they knocked the runs off with a little wobble early on. Joe Root wasn't quite his fluent self, and he's had a fantastic couple of innings out there. But it's a 2-0 away series win. It's always an impressive feat to win away, particularly in Asia. Sri Lanka is not the easiest place to go, but it's straight on to India now, which will be a huge challenge after they won so spectacularly in Australia recently, and it's going to make for a really fascinating series, which will be very, very tough. It's not easy to win in India, but that's what England will be looking to do after an impressive win in Sri Lanka.
All right, that's Tim Nicholls, who's the Deputy Sports Editor of the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. So there's been a bit of a row about a wristband which enables bosses to monitor their employees, not exactly what they're doing, but how happy or unhappy they are. Wearers of the mood beam are asked to track their emotional state using two buttons, yellow for happy, blue for sad. And bosses can then monitor workers via an online dashboard. Is this the answer to the working from home blues? I'm joined by Christine Coleman-McHugh, who's the co-founder of Mood Beam One. Is it a great invasion of our privacy, Christina?
Hi, Andrew. I don't think it is, being honest. I think once people understand, why we created Mood Beam One in the first place and how it's helping sort of people and organisations now, they'll maybe grasp a better understanding that it's more really about them as employees explaining how they feel, how something makes them feel, rather than the employer asking, seeing if they're unhappy or not. I know it sounds like the same language, but actually it's a very different inference when you put it that way.
But why is it important for an employer to know, for instance, whether if I'm working from home, if I'm happy or sad?
Okay.
Are they going to do something about it? Are they going to give me a fat pay rise to cheer me up if it says I'm sad all the time?
Well, that's a good point, actually, because I think to explain where we've come from with this, we originally, Mood Beam One was a personal, and still is, a personal use case product created really by me, for my daughter in the first instance. So it was really a way of starting a conversation, getting to see how somebody's feeling when they're not with you. Fast forward 4 years on, and the relationships that we've built up with organizations really, started to kick in, and they were saying, how on earth when COVID hit and everybody was suddenly having to work from home instead of in branch or on site, they were suddenly saying, how on earth do we find out from, 500 employees every day if they're okay? Because quite frankly, we don't know. We don't know how we can measure that. We don't know if they're happy, unhappy, coping. And rather than sort of being an invasion of privacy, it was really a gentle way of them saying, look, if your technology has worked for people sort of, within mental health, for example, or just seeing if they're coping, do you think it would work in this instance? And we said, well, there's only one way to find out, and, let's give it a go. So that's really how it really evolved very quickly within organizations. We've had relationships built up within the NHS and within education, with banking. And each time it's, what we say is the culture right? Are your employees going to be okay with this, being asked to, wear something initially or around their neck? Are they going to be okay with that? And I think it's a good question to ask, because they may not be ready. There mightn't be every organisation listening to this thinking, we don't know if we are ready for this. Maybe, it's seen as an invasion of privacy, but actually we just want to help and find another way of, getting in earlier so that people don't, start to suffer without being able to speak up about it.
But how do we know that someone's not just going to keep pressing unhappy when there's absolutely nothing wrong with them at all? They're an attention seeker, or they want to do a go. So, I mean, there must be room for this to be abused.
Oh, yeah. I think in every situation where technology or a support mechanism is put in place, there's always the chance that it could be abused. And I think this is where the culture of the organization has got to be right, and the employers and the line managers, whoever it is, they can't sort of say, I know the personality of every single individual working for me, but you would like to think that a line manager maybe would know how somebody is as a person. And this is where we sort of change the language from, happy can be okay. You know, if somebody is maybe naturally of a downbeat temperament, we don't expect them, you know, sort of to be happy all of the time. But if it's when the change occurs, somebody who's maybe normally quite upbeat becomes maybe non-communicative, or the conversations that we've had with HR, you know, in companies is that, you know, we like to think we know our people well, but when a big change happens, we suddenly don't get to see them at the, you know, at the coffee machine, or we don't get to reach out, it's, you know, they, at that stage, they would say, you know, this could be quite useful, rather than sort of, you know, an expectation, you know, it's something that they're given to their employees to carry with them. They don't have to press it. And I think that's really important, is that this isn't forced on people. This is seen right. as a way of having a voice during your working day. Yeah.
And have you got your moonbeam on today? And if you have, is your button on blue for sad or yellow for happy?
I would say that it's a good day, because apart from Alexa going off in this interview, everything's gone all right.
And you're talking to the Daily Mail podcast. What could be better?
Absolutely. Oh, it's great to thank you for inviting me on.
No, it's a pleasure.
And another perspective on it. Thank you.
And listen, and the best of luck to you. That's Christina Coleman-McHugh, who's co-founder of Moodbeam One, who's just about to listen to us on the podcast on Alexa. I hope very much. That's all we've got time for today, I'm afraid, for the latest from the Daily Mail. Download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.